Hello, my name's Alicia Kwan.
And my name's Roshan Desai.
Happy Black History Month. Today we'll be spotlighting our educators. With us we have Ms. Steele.
Today we are going to be interviewing Ms. Steele. And Ms. Steele, could you tell us about yourself and your career path in education?
Sure. So my name is Amy Steele, and I am a former Spanish teacher and also a former school principal. I got my career started by first becoming a North Carolina teaching fellow. And, of course, I graduated from E.E. Smith High School in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Went on to UNC Chapel Hill as a North Carolina teaching fellow and decided that I wanted to teach Spanish. So I studied and then ended up graduating and teaching Spanish here in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, or in the neighboring county, because I live in Cabarrus County now. I taught Spanish for 1 year and then decided to stay home with my children. And so I stayed home for several years before re-entering the career field again as a Spanish teacher here in Cabarrus County Schools. And I remained started teaching and remained a teacher for several years before then becoming an assistant principal and then a principal. So my journey through education has kind of been very typical of what you will see with someone who starts off, in the role as a teacher and then maybe decides to take on leadership roles. So that's what I did.
Thank you. That's amazing. I did not know that. So it's really wonderful to hear that from you. As a Black woman in education, though, what are some of the hardships that you have faced or like learning moments that you've gotten along the way in your workspace?
Yeah, so as a Black woman in the workspace, I think people in general just kind of discount each other's experiences because, as women, we have experiences. As Black women, we have different experiences. Women, and men have different experiences. And it really just would serve us well to kind of take note of each other's experiences and be a little bit more understanding of what a person goes through, especially when they try to articulate what those things are that they've experienced. So for me, what I learned or figured, learned along the way was that it was really up to me to kind of decide how I wanted to engage with people, with my career, with my experiences in that career, and no one else really needed to be responsible for my experience. And so let me contextualize that a little bit. Oftentimes we find ourselves not advocating properly for ourselves because we feel that it's someone else's job to stand up for us. Now, while I do believe that it is up to every individual to kind of say, okay, I'm going to take care of me, and then I'm going to look out for my fellow man, my fellow woman, my, brother, sister, etc., it's also prudent of us to make sure we're doing the things that we need to do to help ourselves. No one is going to come and save us, right? Each individual person has to kind of decide how you're going to interact with people. So I found myself being in this place in my career where I felt like everyone was keeping information from me. I felt like it wasn't, certain things weren't being shared with me. Certain things weren't being told to me. I just didn't know what questions to ask. I didn't know really what I should know, or I didn't know what I didn't know. And so when you find yourself in a place like that, it kind of can feel like the world is against you, or your staff is against you, or people are against you, or your coworkers are against you. When really, it could be that. It could be that they're upset with you because you want to do better with your career as a Black woman. It could be that they really do champion you, but they don't know what else to do. It could be that they're just not concerned about you at all, and you're thinking about yourself way too much, So it could be a host of those things. So over my career, I've kind of learned that it's up to me to set goals for myself, and then it's up to me to try to accomplish those goals and do what needs to be done. The minute you give control of yourself, of you, over to someone else, that's the minute you lose. And so it's extremely important to maintain your own confidence, your own control over your own life to whatever extent possible. I do recognize a higher power. I am a Christian, and I believe in God. And so I believe that God gives me the spiritual, acknowledgement of what is good for me and what is not good for me. And there are some things that we need to kind of take note of when we're working in our careers, just that he will tell you, at least I believe, he will give me what I need to know. And if I don't know that, he'll send someone my way who can help me. But the minute I give over the control of that to someone else, like another human being, as opposed to God or, you know, in alignment with what he tells me to do, that's the minute I feel like I start to lose sight of what my purpose is and what my mission is in life. So that's something I've learned over my career as a Black woman.
Wow, that was really interesting. I really like how you incorporated your religion into it also, because I know a lot of people can relate to that as well. Another thing we wanted to ask you is that since you had so much experience in a school environment, could you tell us about the challenges you've seen the students of color face at your school?
Yeah, I've seen students of color face many challenges. You know, I've had a variety of different types of students of color, whether they're Latino, Latinx, Asian, Black, you know, or some other race of students, which race is a social construct that's really not even real. It's not a real thing. We make it a real thing, and we have racialized our entire society, but it's not a real thing. It's a social construct. It's something that is created to help maintain social status. But I have seen students be mentally bogged down by factors of race that really should not bog them down, whether that's from a socioeconomic perspective, a mental health perspective, an academic perspective, you know, not being given opportunities because someone else thinks that they're not capable or like they're not mentally strong enough. Or in a healthcare space, you know, I've seen students not be given proper health care when they go to their physicians or to their doctors. And it's because, you know, maybe the healthcare physician doesn't believe that the student of color can really articulate his or her feelings about how they feel. And so the student comes back to school with the same recurring sinus infection, which then translates to not being able to focus on his or her reading, which then translates to frustration, which then translates to outbursts in class, which then leads the student to being disproportionately disciplined, and then falling into the school-to-prison pipeline, all of that from a sinus infection. Like, we really have to take note of the lived experiences of children of color, all colors, because the opposite could also be true. I've seen some students have so much pressure on them academically because they're in their culture, they're perceived as a student who is supposed to accomplish X, Y, Z, and when he or she doesn't understand some of the content they're being given, it can be perceived that they're not trying hard enough. And so, you know, all of these things factor into a student, but it's more of a surplus when it's a student of color, because not only do they have to factor in things that happen naturally as being a kid, but then they have to add in their race as a factor in everything they do. And it's just simply not fair. So I really tried over my career to take these kids under my wings because I know how that feels. I know how it feels to be the only one. I know how it feels to be the one, you know, who everyone asks, you know, what do you think? As if it represents the feeling or the sentiment of the entire race, and that's not true. My thoughts are my thoughts, but they're peppered with all of my lived experiences. And I can't speak for an entire race of people, but I can speak for me, and I can speak for those who align with what I'm saying. And so I've really had to step up as a teacher and as an administrator to help those students know that they have someone to talk to. You know, they can be honest and not feel like, oh, my feelings are going to be on display and therefore I can't say what I really want to say, how I want to say it, because someone's going to think I'm yelling or screaming or whatever. When I understand the passion of Latinx students and Black students, I understand the sense of vocabulary utilized. And I know that it's not threatening. You know, to me, it's normal. But to others, it may not be normal. So anyway, I understand the lived experiences of students of color. Let's just say that for sure.
I really, like what you just said about us not being a monolith, that really resonated with me. I really appreciate you bringing that out. On the flip side, however, where do you think the most strides have been for racial equalities in school?
I think the most strides have come from, you know, policy changes and regulations that really lend themselves to see and notice some of the systemic issues and systemic barriers to success. When persons who are in power in political spaces, legal spaces and, you know, other areas are able to make laws and policies that lend themselves to acknowledge that there is a problem, but then propose sensible changes and sensible solutions to those problems, then I feel like the most change can occur at that moment, because at that point there is this recognition of the problem, there is a sustained solution for the problem, and then you have the opportunity to engage in that solution to see if it worked. And if it didn't work, then we can go back to the drawing board and try something different. I think the most challenge comes in when people don't even acknowledge that there's a problem. You know, my favorite non-favorite thing for anyone to say is, you know, I know you're Black, but do you have to be so, like, you know, explicit about it? Like, can't you just get over that? Like, we're all equal. I wish we were all equal. I really wish that. I really hope that that's how people interact with me on a daily basis. But the sad reality is, until you've walked a mile in my shoes, you don't know how people perceive me and perceive people who look like me. And the fact is, the majority culture does not perceive that all people are equal. The majority culture believes that there's an idea that we should all be equal, but others start off ahead of the starting line more so than, you know, other groups. So, you know, non-majority groups start well below or well after the starting line. And starting from behind doesn't make you equal. If I put two students together with very similar upbringings who had access to the same quality schooling, access to the same quality tutors, access to the same socioeconomic status, then yeah, sure, they start off equal. And if they're treated the same all the way through, fine, that's great. Let's see where they land. But when you don't have those equality factors mixed into the equation, you can't just blanketly say that all people are equal, because all people don't experience equality. So.
Thank you. Yes, I agree 100%.
Well, thank you so much for coming and agreeing to talk with us today. We really appreciate it and everything that you have.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. And I hope and wish that you girls will continue your work, whatever your work, wherever your work takes you. Please continue to stay engaged in this space, and thanks for doing what you're doing.
Thank you.